Hello, it's John Dennis on Wednesday the 3rd of June. Today, the most senior scalp so far in the row over MPs' expenses. Jackie Smith is to resign as Home Secretary as Gordon Brown prepares to reshuffle his cabinet.
I think her key moment came in October last year, where in the space of 10 days she had to give up the parliamentary fight over trying to push through 42 days pre-charge detention for terror suspects. And then the next week, she lost a tussle with Boris Johnson, then the new Mayor of London.
In Washington, Barack Obama raises the political stakes as he drives through his crucial environmental legislation ahead of global climate talks in December.
If the US wants to play the lead here in getting a climate change treaty out of the Copenhagen talks, which, you know, are just 6 months away, it has to show that it's willing to act at home.
And why New Zealand is the most peaceful country on earth.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Bill Overton's got the news.
Brazilian military planes have discovered debris in the Atlantic Ocean that the government confirms is the remains of the missing Air France Airbus. Spotter planes found a three-mile-long line of debris floating in the sea 400 miles off the Brazilian coast. Ships are on their way to begin the salvage and the search for the plane's black box. The Air France flight AF447 disappeared in thunderstorms on its way from Rio de Janeiro to Paris on Monday night. There's now no chance of any of the 228 passengers surviving. A detainee at Guantanamo Bay has died in an apparent suicide, the fifth at the US prison for terror suspects in Cuba. The Yemeni prisoner accused of fighting for the Taliban had been held at Guantanamo since 2002. An American lawyer says Mohamed Salih was one of a group of six who'd been on long-term hunger strike. Prison staff have been force-feeding them. The president has called for the prison to be closed by the end of the year. President Obama begins a peacemaking trip to the Muslim world today. He starts his visit in Saudi Arabia and then goes to Egypt, where he is making a long-awaited speech, reaching out to former American opponents like Iran. He's hoping to move forward the peace process between Israel and the Palestinian territories. Two people suffering from swine flu have been put into intensive care in Scotland. The Health Protection Agency says there are now 362 cases of the flu in Britain, 61 more cases reported in just one day. The World Health Organization says it's getting closer to a global outbreak. More than 100 people have died from the flu, and it's reached 64 different countries. Prime Minister Gordon Brown faces a tough session of parliamentary questions today. Yesterday, more Labour MPs announced they're standing down at the next election, among them Beverly Hughes, the Children's Minister. The Home Secretary Jackie Smith and Cabinet Office Minister Tom Watson both say they'll be leaving the Cabinet in the coming reshuffle. All the morning papers see this as the beginning of the end for Gordon Brown's government. The Guardian calls it Labour's Day of Resignation. The Telegraph headline reads, Cabinet Meltdown. In The Independent, they call it disarray in Downing Street. The Financial Times says the minister's jumped ship, but the Mail goes further with rats desert sinking ship. Speculation is rife as to how long the PM can last, with The Express talking about meltdown for Brown and The Mirror playing with melt Brown. The Mail says ministers are scrambling for the exits as PM faces an election rout and reshuffle nightmare. The Times says Brown's authority wanes, and the FT says his colleagues are urging him to bring forward his reshuffle before the local and European election results to show his authority. The Guardian goes out on a limb calling for Brown to resign now, the day after it urged voters to choose the Liberal Democrats as their choice for the European Parliament. The paper prints a whole-page leader outlining Gordon Brown's failings. It says, the truth is there is no vision from Brown, no argument for the future and no support. The public see it. His party sees it. Labour has a year left before an election. Its current leader would waste it. It is time to cut him loose. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, has told Gordon Brown she wants to leave the government. Smith's political future was thrown into doubt when it emerged that she'd claimed expenses for two pornographic films watched by her husband. Cabinet Office Minister Tom Watson is also reported to be on his way out of the government when the Prime Minister reshuffles his cabinet after this weekend's local and European election results, which are expected to be dire for Labour. And the expenses row has thrown other ministerial careers into jeopardy, including that of Geoff Hoon, the Transport Secretary, and Alistair Darling, the Chancellor. Meanwhile, Families Minister Beverly Hughes, former Health Secretary Patricia Hewitt and MP David Chater say they'll stand down at the next election. In our Westminster office, our political editor Patrick Winter gives his reaction to Jackie Smith's departure.
It's not a surprise. The timing is surprising. There have been many stories suggesting she was going to stand down at the time of the reshuffle. What was unusual was that there were important people around in the Home Office who were yesterday willing to confirm this and to give detailed reasoning and an explanation around the way in which she felt personally demoralised, both for herself and for her family, about the expenses for Argo, in particular the fact that someone in her family had claimed for a sex video on expenses, taxpayers' expenses, and she had proposed to Gordon Brown that she stand down when this story first broke, and that it was finally agreed last Easter that she would stand down at the time of this coming reshuffle. So all this detail was emerging from the Home Office.
To what extent do you think a reshuffle will reinvigorate Gordon Brown's government?
I think out the general public will be shifting of rather familiar figures and very little impact at all in the short term. Reshuffles can work in the sense that you can have departments that are stuck in a rut, they've got an unpopular policy, they need to change, someone with fresh eyes can look at it and say this needs to be dropped. And the second thing is that you, with just a year to go before a general election, you really want to focus on campaigning kind of individuals rather than on very good administrators. So you don't necessarily want the person who's the best person to run a Whitehall department. You want the best person to beat the hell out of the Conservatives or the Liberal Democrats. And that would be the argument for Ed Balls, although some people seem as a very divisive figure inside Labour circles.
Jackie Smith is the most senior politician to have resigned over the expenses row. She was also one of the first to get caught up in it.
It's hard totally to sort of disentangle the degree to which she feels actually sort of that she's done anything seriously culpable over her expenses. She admits there's obviously been a gross error and very embarrassing at a personal level error over this sort of sex video, but she still insists that the way in which she designated her second homes was correct and that she will be vindicated when a report is prepared by the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards, because there had been speculation that she was standing down in the knowledge that the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards were going to find against her, and Home Office sources have been insisting that is not the case.
Patrick Winter. Well, Jackie Smith has had a tough 2 years as Home Secretary. The Guardian's Home Affairs editor, Alan Travis, assesses her performance.
Well, I think you can't take away from the fact that she was the first woman Home Secretary that this country's ever had, and that in itself is an impressive achievement in her political career. Having said that, it's unfortunately a career which probably ended in failure, but failure not about expenses, but I think her key moment came in October last year, where in the space of 10 days she had to give up the parliamentary fight over trying to push through 42 days pre-charge detention for terror suspects. And then the next week she lost a tussle with Boris Johnson, then the new Mayor of London, over the future of Ian Blair. So Ian Blair, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, and which she lost again, and he, as a result, stepped down. The result of these two events, I think, was that her political authority basically ebbed away in the job, and so that when the expenses row, and she was one of the first to be leaked against in that respect, hit the national media, she found that there was not the kind of level of support around the cabinet to, that she should carry on. It wasn't said around Whitehall and Westminster, but she's been a great Home Secretary with any great conviction. And I think that hit her quite hard as well, and I think she made up her mind about Easter time that she wouldn't carry on as Home Secretary in terms of her own personal sort of catharsis over it. And she told Brown then that she was going to go.
The Home Office was described by Jackie Smith's predecessor, John Reid, as not fit for purpose. In what sort of state does Jackie Smith leave the department?
Unquestionably better than that which John Reid put it in. One of the more controversial aspects of her Home Secretaryship was the fact that she finally put an end to the hugely damaging and repetitive and persistent leaks against it. Unfortunately, this was done through overreacting in the arrest of Damien Green, the shadow immigration spokesman. But in terms of moles, she acted quite effectively there. But also the basic day-to-day working of the department, immigration and so on, has not been suffered from the same complete dysfunctional elements. To her credit, she has waged significant campaigns on violence against women, particularly prostitution, and also in trying to improve local accountability of the police at a local level, crime maps, the local policing pledge. But most of this has been conducted through the level of the regional media, constituency visits, way below the radar of national media, and as such, she may have mistakenly appeared as a do-nothing Home Secretary.
And in terms of candidates to replace Jackie Smith?
Well, interesting question, really. It seems to be a longer list of people who are scrabbling to avoid being made Home Secretary for the sake of their future political career than those who are lining up to do the job. It's said that this now gives Gordon Brown the opportunity to go to Alistair Darling and say, look, your £600 you paid back on your expenses, I'm sorry, means you can't carry on as Chancellor, but here is the job of Home Secretary. How about that, Alistair? That's the sort of top favourite current position. It's said that Alan Johnson might be offered the job as a future leadership contender, a way of binding him in to the Brown government for the last 12 months. However, the exception of Jim Callaghan, nobody has gone on from being Home Secretary to the job of Prime Minister or leader of the Labour Party. So it could be a bit of a poison chalice in that respect. Amongst the younger generation, James Purnell's mentioned. The two Eds always mentioned in this state, Balls and Miliband, but I doubt it. I'd probably put my money on Darling at the moment.
Alan Travis, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, Greg Sams, who's credited with starting the whole foods craze in Britain and inventing the veggie burger, talks to John Crace at guardian.co.uk/food. Jonathan Jones, our art critic, reviews Richard Long at Tate Britain, that's at guardian.co.uk/art, and the 17th century Morrissey is revealed at guardian.co.uk/culture. Barack Obama is prepared to intervene directly to ensure passage of America's first law to reduce the carbon emissions that cause global warming. Congressional leaders are working against a six-month deadline to pass a sweeping package of laws before global climate change talks begin in Copenhagen in December. In Washington, Suzanne Goldenberg is our U.S. environment correspondent.
We aren't quite clear yet what Barack Obama will do to try and push through climate change legislation, but I think it's important to note that he is going to weigh in on this issue. The reason there's uncertainty is that while the bill has cleared its first hurdle, the Energy Committee of the House of Representatives, it has as many as 8 other committees are now going to review that package, and its shape could change along the way.
And what kind of intervention might we see from the president?
Well, last month we saw Barack Obama summon a number of key members of Congress to the White House to talk to him about the bill. That came at a very important time. It looked like the bill was losing momentum, that it could all fall apart. And Obama basically called on these people and explained to them how important the bill was to his agenda. And he sort of set their minds at ease about the economic costs of moving to a clean energy economy. And people who were at that meeting last night say it was pivotal to getting those Democratic members of Congress to come on side and swing behind the climate change bill.
Is the administration confident that the legislation will be passed intact, given that it's got to go through so many different committee stages?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, how much more will this legislation be watered down? We don't know that yet. And remember, it has to go through committee stages. It has to have a vote on the floor of the House. But it's still not an actual law until it also goes through the Senate. So there's lots of steps along the way where this could become unraveled. Nancy Sutley, who is Barack Obama's advisor in the White House on climate change, made it quite clear to me that he isn't going to feel compelled to weigh in to prop up specific targets for emission reductions, but there are other areas where she said he's going to reserve the right to make a personal intervention, specifically on the issue of allowances and of protecting consumers and ordinary Americans from high spikes in electricity costs.
And just to put this into context, Suzanne, this legislation is crucial not just for the United States, but for global efforts to tackle climate change.
Absolutely. It's become increasingly clear that if the U.S. wants to play the lead here in getting a climate change treaty out of the Copenhagen talks, which, you know, are just 6 months away, it has to show that it's willing to act at home. So the whole world is watching this. China, the European Union, India, all the big polluters are watching to see what America does next.
Suzanne Goldenberg. It's Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in today's programme, as Ryanair reports its first loss in 20 years, is there a future for budget airlines?
Aer Lingus has had a torrid 2 years, and the value of the stake has just crumbled from around €400 million to around €93 million. And that's resulted in Ryanair, an immensely profitable airline, being dragged into the red.
But first, the Global Peace Index is put together by an Australian think tank. It ranks countries according to their relative states of peace, and it's named New Zealand as the world's most peaceful nation, while Iraq comes bottom of the list. Our diplomatic editor Julian Borgia has the details.
It's a formula put together with a whole number of criteria. I think there are 23 altogether. Takes in the number of wars each country is involved, whether they're internal conflicts, number of murders, number of guns in circulation, all those elements that go to making up the peacefulness or otherwise of a society. And they weight these different criteria differently according to how much they believe they have an impact on the peacefulness of a nation, and they come out with this ranking. To some extent, you know, there's an element of arbitrariness about it, but they believe that the criteria that they've identified are real drivers towards, you know, stability on one hand and violence on the other.
And Iceland last year was rated the world's most peaceful nation, but no longer.
That's right. And the argument they're making is this is a credit crunch at work, that the global recession has had an important impact on peacefulness, stability on the world as a whole. It's a slightly less peaceful, slightly less stable world than it was last year. But also it had a very focused impact on Iceland, which was seen as this haven of stability where nothing interesting ever happened, a sort of Viking tiger as well, a very vibrant banking financial sector. And as we know, that all imploded horrifically last year altogether, the economy, the banking sector, the currency all took a nosedive. And that's had taken them off the top spot because there's been unrest, there's been uncertainty about the future of the government. Doesn't seem as quite as stable place as it was last year. Nevertheless, it's still up there in the top five, well above countries like Great Britain, for example.
Where is the UK?
I think we're at 35, which is an improvement on last year, but we're still behind Botswana and most of Europe. But interestingly, one position ahead of Italy.
And what at the other end of the scale, Iraq is at the very bottom, below Afghanistan. Is that a surprise?
It was to me because of this much vaunted surge that has increased stability and undoubtedly has increased stability in Iraq, but it doesn't seem to have been enough to pull it off the bottom of the table. It's below Afghanistan, even below Somalia. So perhaps a surprise there.
Julian Borgia. Ryanair, Europe's largest budget carrier, has reported its first loss in 20 years. It was dragged into the red by a sharp decline in the value of the rival Irish airline Aer Lingus, in which Ryanair holds a stake. Dan Milmo is our transport correspondent.
Aer Lingus has had a torrid 2 years, and the value of the stake has just crumbled from around €400 million to around €93 million, and that's resulted in Ryanair, an immensely profitable airline, being dragged into the red.
What went wrong with its attempted takeover of Aer Lingus?
Well, Aer Lingus is controlled by the Irish government and unions, trade unions, who have quite a strong position in the airline. Between them, they control about 40% of Aer Lingus, which outweighs Ryanair's still pretty mighty near 30%. But they took one look at the prospect of being run by an airline that famously doesn't really encourage unionisation and wants to really take an axe to Aer Lingus's business model, and said, no way.
Now, when you take Aer Lingus out of the equation, what does Ryanair's performance look like?
It's not great compared with recent years, but its underlying performance is profitable, and that is quite a big achievement in an airline market that globally is doing very, very badly indeed and is forecast to lose collectively billions of pounds over the next 2 years.
What has the Ryanair chief executive Michael O'Leary said about the airline's prospects?
I spoke to Michael O'Leary, and he was characteristically voluble and enthusiastic form. He said that the airline's prospects were bloody brilliant, and then went on to talk about not only owning more than 200 jets by 2012, but owning something like 400 jets by 2016. Just to put that into context for listeners, that really would make Ryanair quite an astonishing force in European aviation. It's already the biggest domestic carrier in Europe. But with around about 400 planes, you can't imagine travelling anywhere without it being on a Ryanair plane, frankly. They would be a very, very big player. And it would inevitably lead into thoughts about Ryanair becoming a long-haul carrier. Because once you start to have such a dominant role in short-haul, eventually you start thinking about, perhaps I can switch these passengers onto a long-haul flight, which is effectively what the likes of BA and Virgin do. They have BA has a short-haul network that has been chipped away at by EasyJet and Ryanair. But that short-haul network feeds passengers onto long-haul destinations like New York, Mumbai, Cape Town. And you could see Ryanair eventually thinking, okay, well, we won't serve them much food on their 12-hour flight, but let's try putting them on one nonetheless.
And Michael O'Leary's gone to extraordinary lengths to cut costs. He's now considering charging passengers to use the toilet.
Once again, you've got to take what Michael says with a pinch of salt. And indeed, when he first raised this a couple of months ago, his spokesperson put out quite an amusing statement, basically slapping down his own chief executive. But Michael O'Leary repeated it again today. He said, "We are considering it." And it does sound fantastical, absurd, and will lead to many complaints, not only on probably a legal basis, but if you look back 20 years ago and ask people, would you be willing to pay for a packet of crisps on your flight? They probably would have said, no, that's outrageous. That's impinging on my consumer rights. If you'd asked them, do you mind awfully paying £20 for checking in your bag? They would have said, no, this is a disgrace. I will sue. Well, all that's happened now. So while the idea of needing your credit card to go to the loo on a flight sounds absurd, I wouldn't put it past Ryanair. It's a big player. It's very powerful. If they really do want to put credit card locks on their toilet doors, it is going to happen.
Dan Milmo, Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.